Welcome to Friday. You made it. I'm Bill Radke. It's time for the Week in Review, and I'm so happy to have on our panel today Paul Guppy, Vice President for Research at the Free Market Washington Policy Center. Hey, Paul.
Hey, good afternoon.
Joni Bolter, host of Civic Cocktail, former Seattle Times columnist. Great to see you, Joni.
Good to see you as well.
And how about Brian Baird, former Democratic congressman, represented the southwest corner of our state for a dozen years in D.C., right?
Yep.
Welcome to KUOW.
Happy to be with you.
So I'm just starting to be able to see all of you, the smoke. Maybe it seems like it's just cleared a little bit, but how are you doing on the smoke?
We're going from white skies to blue skies slowly, and I do mean slowly.
Yeah. Everybody okay? Hope your lungs are
challenge.
Good.
Our kids are getting a little respiratory ailments, I'm afraid.
My kid was coughing quite a bit last night. We'll talk a little about smoke and fires and other stuff on the Week in Review. I want to start with the idea that Seattle is an ultimate target for Kim Jong-un. So said the president of the National Bureau of Asian Research. Seattle is an ultimate target. And we know that North Korea has, we know that the Washington Post says that the Pentagon thinks that North Korea has figured out how to put a nuclear warhead on a missile that could reach us. President Trump said this week, lots of stuff. You heard about the fire and fury, and most recently he said military solutions are now fully in place, locked and loaded. So what happens next? Well, I asked Washington Congressman Adam Smith, the ranking Democrat on the House Armed Services Committee, and he said what happens next probably is a years-long, maybe decades-long standoff where North Korea has nukes and missiles, and so do we, like the Cold War.
North Korea will not attack us, and we will not attack them because the cost would be too high for either party to do that.
I don't hear you being scared. Would you tell us if you were scared?
There is never a time when being scared is the correct and appropriate way to respond to a threat. I mean, look, you live life. I mean, I have two children. You know, my daughter goes out with her friends at night. I'm nervous. There's a million things that can go wrong in life. That's just the way it is. You have to be able to process that, not spend all your time being scared. So if you're asking me, does it make sense to be scared? The answer is always no, because it simply doesn't help you.
You agree? Being scared never helps you?
I think being scared in this situation is just not going to be helpful, because we have two people with this war of words who are so alike in so many ways. They love to throw insults and, hey, you know, what are you going to do about that? And what am I going to do about that?
You're talking about Trump and Kim.
Yes. And so you have, you know, man boy versus man baby. And what they're doing is escalating something that clearly needs to be de-escalated. We've had other presidents that knew how to talk differently about this.
Is that clear? Do we know that the situation with North Korea has been escalated because of Trump's rhetoric?
Well,
Kim's rhetoric.
Sure. So I might disagree with Joni a little bit here that it's escalating because North Korea is escalating it. So what we're seeing is the result of 25 years of foreign policy that didn't work under Democrat and Republican presidents. And so I think it helps to kind of step back and see how we got in the situation that we are today. I'm not necessarily defending Trump's approach, but what I mean is that he's the current president who is reacting to a relationship with North Korea, which has been breaking down, I guess you'd say, over the past 2.5 decades. And the reason is because it's North Korea that continues to push forward with their nuclear program and their intercontinental missiles. And that's how we end up facing that threat today.
Well, Paul's right about that. But the question is, what an unfortunate time to have someone like Mr. Trump as the president, a person who lacks historical awareness, responds on just impulse and the complexity. You know, Trump said a while back when he was running for office that it would be so easy to solve Mosul. You'll just go in, capture the ISIS guys, and fly right back out. He has no appreciation for complexity, and this is about as complex as it gets. This whole idea that a military solution is locked and loaded only if you're willing to see millions of people die on both sides.
Exactly. And so that's the problem with having a president who thinks in 140 characters. I mean, he doesn't go into the depths of this and the complexity of this. He's used to saying things and watching everyone scramble to see what they're going to do to respond. And the problem here is that apparently North Korea now has the capability to use missiles. They've had nukes for a while. Then we've always been watching. Do they have now the capability to actually send them anywhere? And the threat from North Korea now is that Guam, what did they do? You know,
they're too close to North Korea.
That is what they did.
It's very easy to agree that Trump is bellicose and has an unhelpful manner and all kinds of things like that. It seems obviously true. But, you know, Reagan called Russia an evil empire, and that was stupid, and we called him Ronnie Reagans, and we were all going to die, and we're still here.
We won.
And, well, we won, you could say. So I'm kind of, maybe that's what Congressman Smith means by the idea that fear and the idea that Trump, he's so bellicose, he's not measured. Well, yeah, we know he's not measured. So
that's exactly the point I was going to make, is that there's no question that Trump's style is, you know, rough and outspoken, but the underlying policy is really the same as the policy we had with the Soviet Union for 45 years. So Eisenhower, Truman, you know, Nixon, Ford, Carter, John F. Kennedy, Reagan, they all had the same strategy, which is not necessarily one that I like. There was no other choice, and that is massive mutual assured destruction, where we were consistently saying to the Soviet Union, if you start a war with us or our allies in the way we deter you from invading Germany or Europe is you are facing a nuclear threat and we need to defuse that and stand down, which we eventually did. But that went on for 45 years. And it seems like now we're falling into the same policy with North Korea, where the only thing we can say to them, and I agree, you know, Trump may be overboard, but the underlying national policy remains the same. And that is a threat against North Korea if they attack us or one of our allies.
The problem, there are a couple other problems, though. I mean, when we say we won after Reagan's bellicose comments, that was not just because of Reagan's policies. We had Mikhail Gorbachev, fortunately, in Russia, and cooler heads prevailed. We don't see any sign of that on the horizon.
The Soviet Union collapsed. So when that hostile regime was gone, then the threat disappeared.
Well, it temporarily was suspended, I suppose. But the challenge here is we may have to make some extremely tough decisions. And does this president have the credibility? Two possible options. And we don't hear a lot about options. One is that to put pressure on the Chinese, we engage in some serious economic consequences. And we say to the American people and American businesses, we are going to hurt economically in order to put pressure on the Chinese to do something. And that's a reasonable thing, I think. And it may have to hurt a lot. But if there were an immediate embargo on Chinese goods coming in, or the threat of that until they put this madman away in some way, that changes the game. Or even a demonstration shot of something really big off the coast of North Korea, that's a heck of a move. But the question is, could a President Trump inspire global respect and support and a measured response? And that's where we're hurting here, because we're going to have to. If your neighbor said, I have a really big gun and I hate you and I will kill you one day, you'd want the police to come in and kill your neighbor. And it'd be very hard for you to say, oh, I don't mind that he's my neighbor. I don't think he'll do it because I'd kill him back. If he's crazy and he's got a weapon, you want him stopped.
So back to my original question from the congressman. Fear, you ever useful? Is fear ever a good thing?
Well, it's a good thing if it helps you.
Fear on both sides is useful here. Right?
Mutual fear.
Mutually
fear, assured
terror.
But not
like daily fear. It's just that they both are afraid of what each will do. And that will, as Congressman Smith said, give us a year or three on this.
Yeah. So fear is a good thing if it makes you concerned and aware, and if it makes you informed about what the conflict is. I think that's a good thing. Living daily, and I think this is what Congressman Smith was getting at, and he's right, and certainly people of a certain generation remember growing up during the Cold War under a nuclear threat, and yet your day-to-day life was pretty good. At least your parents tried to keep it that way. So I think that's what he's referring to, is that we need to go about our daily lives, but this is a situation that's becoming increasingly tense internationally, and I think we need to be very aware of it and keep track.
And we need other people who can speak for us who don't speak in these 140 character, you know, big fits and furies.
Then we can rest easy so they can decide what the proper psychological. Well, I mean, aren't you a former, you're a psychologist, aren't you?
I am.
Congressman Baird?
Yeah.
Do you have a psychologist view on on all of this?
Well, the issue, as Paul said and Joni said, look, and I think Adam's right, living in fear isn't going to help us. On the other hand, if you had to say, is the risk we face higher today than it was a couple of months ago? Yes. Mm-hmm. And objectively, especially living on the West Coast, this is a serious problem. The hard part is to live in fear and realize that the solutions you desperately want to happen are far more complex than you wish they were. And that's the situation. And also, frankly, the average citizen in America can't do anything about this.
Yeah, there you go. What are you going to do with your fear? Move out of range?
I think what you
vote,
do is...
You can decide how to vote?
Move to Idaho. I think that's it.
Well, I think you can also say, is this the kind of person we wish we had elected to deal with this? Now, some say, yeah, I want a tough-talking guy. But people who say that, I don't think have thought through the consequences. If Japan gets hit with a nuclear weapon, if American bases, we got 30,000 soldiers in South Korea, we could lose a lot of people in a very, very, very short time, a matter of literally 3 or 4 minutes, and millions of people can die. And
sure, but Trump didn't create that situation.
I'm not
using
this to blame on Trump.
Oh,
I'm saying I wish we had elected someone with a more sophisticated and deep understanding of the complexity of the situation.
And more credibility in the world.
Yeah, that's
the point. That's very important.
He's who we have now.
Yeah.
So I just think we have to, you know, hope that our national leaders, including the cabinet, the Secretary of State, the Secretary of Defense, and the other advisors working as a group together, not just Trump by himself, will come up with a policy that defends our country.
And who is Seattle going to have at the helm? We're deciding that. We're going to talk about the latest in the mayoral election and what Seattle's going to do about homelessness and what to do about the trampling mountain goats of the Olympic National Park. It's the Week in Review coming up. This is The Week in Review. We're on Twitter, at KUOW. I'm Bill Radke with Joni Balter and Paul Guppy and Brian Baird. We're having a reasonable discussion. Former Congressman Baird, your podcast is called...
A Reasonable Discussion.
Right, right. That's it. I was on the tip of my tongue.
Well done.
It's right there.
So let's talk about the election that we just had and are still dealing with. It looks like Seattle's mayor will either be Jenny Durkin or Carrie Moon. There still could be a recount, right?
We do like to marinate the ballots as slow as possible just to keep the intrigue going.
Just to
keep
it interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. Joni, odds of a recount?
You know, there's a chance there will be a recount, and that could change things. Yeah. It's right in that neighborhood of requiring a recount, or Nikita Oliver, the one who's on the wrong side of the ballots right now, could actually ask for one as well.
Have to pay for it?
Not one? Could she say, look, I don't want to put the public through the expense?
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, unless she goes below 0.5%, the difference goes below 0.5%.
So she could concede any time, and
she
at
could
which
concede
point
it
would, that would end the counting if she doesn't want to go forward.
Unless the final ballots go to 0.5%.
Then it's mandatory.
Then it's mandatory.
Okay. Yeah. So it probably Jenny Durkin or Carrie Moon, could be Nikita Oliver. I asked State Republican Party Chair Susan Hutchison this week, does it matter that we talked about a lot of stuff? One question was, does it matter that a woman will be the mayor of Seattle?
Well, if she's competent, it will be good for the people of Seattle. And I think that certainly Jenny Durkin has a long and distinguished career, and she seems to know what she's doing. We certainly need something in the city of Seattle.
Paul, how do you think the Durkin campaign likes the endorsement of the state Republican Party?
maybe from their point of view, lack of opposition helps them the most. So the reason that Susan Hutchison, I think, is able to make that kind of detached comment is because there isn't an active Republican in the race. And once again, the people of Seattle, I live in Seattle, you are free to vote for the liberal Democrat of your choice. It's really a one-party.
It's your freedom.
Town.
It's up to you.
Yeah. Vote for whichever left-leaning Democrat is available.
Well, that is one way to look at it.
The comment wasn't about ideology. It was about competence.
Exactly. And I was just going to add that. So the underlying point beyond party labels is somebody who can competently run the city. And that's exactly what we're looking for.
Yeah.
Well, is it a choice of two liberal Democrats? Because I've also heard this election compared to Bernie Hillary. Am I the only one who keeps hearing the idea that Jenny Durkin is the Hillary establishment, Carrie Moon or Nikita Oliver equals the Bernie insurgency? Is that helpful?
Oh, gosh. Who wants to relive Bernie Hillary? Not me, that's for sure. And I also don't think the comparison really works. I mean,
tell us about that.
The maybe the first time in my life I've agreed with Susan Hutchinson about the competence and the importance of that. And Jenny Durkin is certainly the front runner, and she certainly has demonstrated a ton of leadership kind of skills, executive kind of skills.
What do you mean by that?
Because she was a U.S. attorney and she did a great job. She led police reform. But this is no flaming conservative, if I can get away with a phrase like that. This is a Seattle progressive. But in as we do with our, and I say this all the time, 31 flavors of liberals around here, this Seattle progressive is probably, most likely, going to be running against Carrie Moon. I think one of the interesting things Carrie Moon could do, I really don't have a sense of Carrie Moon because she sort of hangs back and is vague about a lot of things, but maybe Carrie Moon, to try to capture the excitement of Nikita Oliver, does something like, you know, in advance says she'll be an advisor, in advance teams with her, because there's a lot of energy behind Nikita Oliver
to pick up
that has to go somewhere.
But how is
you
the
can see that
you said the Hillary Bernie comparison is not apt? Why is that? Because you could say, well, Hillary Clinton is a liberal.
Yeah, but I'm not here to turn Jenny Durkin into Hillary Clinton, because it
well,
just is too.
How does it not add up? That's what I'm asking.
I just don't buy it. I don't think it's the right comparison.
There may be some. Of the folks who supported Bernie going one way and folks who support Jenny going another, that's going to happen in any election. But to try to suggest that Jenny Durkin and Hillary are the same, or that either of the other two candidates are the same as Bernie, is a stretch. It's an overly convenient stretch. It's sort of our need for tribalism.
Yes.
Why not let them stand as who they are and their policies be who they are and set back the last?
Because humans make analogies. That's what we do.
Yeah, I think. But in
especially
this case,
radio humans.
Yeah.
Well, So this is why political science is so fascinating, is that you are always going to have, you know, factions and differences of opinions and people who share the same concerns coming together behind a candidate. And you mentioned 31 flavors of liberalism. This race started with 21 candidates.
Yeah.
So
I missed 10.
Yeah, well, that, you know, maybe it doesn't represent, you know, the conservative or the Republican side, but it's definitely a wide variety of opinion on the left or the far left, however you want to label it. And so now we're down to two. And you're going to have that same dynamic, which always happens in a democracy, which I think is a healthy thing. The candidate who came in second looks to the ones who didn't make it at all and tries to pick up their supporters. So it's all about additive math. And Jenny Durkin did extremely well. She had nearly double the support of her next closest rival. So that means that Carrie Moon would go to the non-Durkin vote, right, and try to draw those supporters in.
And that's a big number.
The non-Durkin vote is a big number.
And
I mean, Jenny Durkin
up,
got 28%.
So right. Yeah, but that's still small compared to all the people who didn't vote at all.
Oh, absolutely.
Don't care, and they're just now tuning in.
So the general, that's another important factor. So the general electorate is a different election. It's vastly larger. So even though we're down to two candidates, really this race is starting over again.
It is.
Congressman knows this,
that's
having
right.
done it many times,
right.
is that going into the general, you're not just talking about two or three times as many people. It's like 10 times as many
right.
people.
There
are many more votes to get.
Did we see any impact from the vouchers? Any tangible impact?
No, not that I saw.
It hasn't really been analyzed.
It hasn't been.
Yeah,
it's our first real experiment with it.
These are Seattle's democracy vouchers. Yeah. People get mailed the ability to donate $25.
Yeah, you have to. It's opt-in, so you have to ask, and then you can give $25 to up to each of four candidates.
Yeah.
Or all you can give $100 to one candidate.
I certainly don't think that will be a deciding factor in any way.
No, I don't.
You know?
I was just curious. It's kind of an experiment.
It is an experiment. I think in this race, it's really going to be, you know, which of these people can stir enthusiasm for themselves. And for me, Carrie Moon needs to go to candidate school, because she has a way to go in explaining what she believes. That she try to keep her distance from issues sometimes. She says, I'm going to study everything. You know, you really have to be clearer about what you are. Maybe among 21 candidates, that's fine. But from here on
and
out.
We'll talk more about this. Apparently, we don't seem to have a Carrie Moon partisan on this particular panel choice. My question is, would Moon and her supporters, if it's Carrie Moon, be wise to portray Durkin as the establishment? Because doesn't the establishment tend to vote, and the establishment has money to spend if you convince them that they're under threat from an insurgency? Is that a wise strategy to, I've sure heard that label so far, establishment, fair or not.
Yeah, well, let's go back to McGinn and Ed Murray race 4 years ago. Ed Murray was the establishment candidate, and it didn't hurt him. I mean, sometimes you can laugh at some of these names that Ed Murray's establishment, the guy who helped deliver, you know, gay marriage, gay rights in this state. I think it's a way forward for Carrie Moon to say she's the establishment.
You think it's helpful, politically helpful?
I think it could politically help her.
Okay.
And I think capturing some of Nikita Oliver's supporters clearly would be helpful.
But I think people there are a lot of challenges facing the city and a lot of opportunities. And I think people are going to be looking at who do we think is telling us and has the ability not to just tell us something, but actually has the ability to implement some real solutions to some really longstanding intransigent problems. And I think that's how they ought to run the race. I mean, one could politically strategize, I'm going to take this posture, this. Tell us who you are, what you can do, and what you plan to do, and we'll make the decision. I mean, I think that's the better strategy for candidates.
Which is exactly what I was going to say. Yeah. So you're sure, if you're Carrie Moon, you're a challenger, it's about identity and branding. You need to get your name out there. The thing I was going to add to that is that on local races, you just have to recognize the kind of office you're running for. You're not running for United States Senate or even governor, where larger issues are involved. When you're looking at city council and mayor, people are concerned about quality of life issues in the city, how it's governed. In that sense, it's non-ideological. And Carrie Moon, who I think can position herself as more of a challenger, even though it's an open race, but she can take advantage of that sort of underdog status and then build her reputation on how to deal with real problems in the city that people see every day.
One of the real problems in this city, homelessness, and we're going to talk about the idea of easing up when it comes to enforcement on parking tickets, impound fees, towing of people who live in their cars. That and more coming up on The Week in Review. Stick around. Paul Guppy is Vice President for Research at the Washington Policy Center, which has a Husky student club.
That's right. We have an official club on 4 campuses around the state, and the University of Washington is one of those.
On Seattle Channel, Joni Balter hosts Civic Cocktail, and Brian Baird, former Democratic congressman from the southwest corner of the state for 12 years, and now a Week in Review panelist. And I'm Bill Radke, and we are talking about some of the top stories this week. And when I say homelessness, you might think of people sleeping in alleyways or in tent camps. But at any one time, maybe a third or maybe more of Seattle's homeless people are living in their cars, trucks, vans, RVs. And here's the conundrum. If you park too long in one spot, you get a ticket. If you don't pay your tickets, you owe more money. And your home might get towed away. And that costs more money. And how can you rent a home if you spent what little money you had on parking tickets and impound fees? So now the city is considering letting some people who live in their vehicles to park for long periods without racking up tickets. Here's City Council member Mike O'Brien.
If I have an individual, whether they're suffering from poverty or some mental health challenges, but are engaging productively with the city on trying to get stabilized and back into housing, accumulating parking tickets or towing their vehicle has a very destabilizing effect. I don't want them to take their minimal amount of resources that they might have and have them paying parking fines. I want them to be saving that money for a down payment or deposit on moving into housing whenever they find that.
Brian, we have a way to avoid tickets. You move your car every 3 days. What's wrong with that system?
Well, I think that the challenge here is one wants to be compassionate about people who are down on their luck or are suffering from addiction or mental illness, and we need to be compassionate. On the other hand, the rights and quality of life of folks who would be impacted by some rig parked in front of their house for a couple of weeks also need to be respected. And so, you know, we could play a sort of a whack-a-mole game and force people to chase around the city, or we could try to find a bigger solution to a much deeper and broader problem. And one of the challenges here is, it seems to me as I read this, legitimate for the people who are affected, but yet another Band-Aid approach to a much more complex problem. And in some ways, a Band-Aid that passes the problem onto the folks who didn't create the problem themselves.
Yeah, you're talking about, you said rigs parked alongside houses, and there's still some questions. There's a lot of debate about what's actually going to happen and what's going to be proposed. The latest I've heard in the Seattle Times version, I read about maybe 40 to 50 safe parking zones, like six vehicle-sized zones scattered around the city, so it's not like a free-for-all everywhere, and it's people who are it's like there's going to be, you have to sign up, I guess. It's the like a program of people saying, I live in my vehicle, and then the city wants to then, oh, well, now we can cooperate with you. We can help you get services. That's what they're hoping for, Joni.
Yeah, so I'm going to agree with something Danny Westnead in the Seattle Times wrote. We're trying to slice here a little bit, as Brian said as well, between compassion and enforcement. And we have to be careful not to do all accommodation or, you know, all enforcement. So where I would end up on this is if you end up with a few parking lots, designated parking lots that have services and sanitation, that's one thing. But the other thing is you got to remember, this is Mike O'Brien 101 in some ways. He's the same council member who wanted homeless camping in the parks and on the sidewalks. We have to be careful here that we don't set up a system where you have two sets of rules, one set for law-abiding taxpayers and another set for a group that needs the compassion. It really is tricky, but you have to be careful here because Mike O'Brien seems to keep leaning towards this accommodation.
Sure, which doesn't get at the root problem that people have as to why they end up being homeless in the first place, why they live on the streets. So I think I agree with your comments, definitely, that but it becomes, in practice, it actually becomes false compassion, because what the city is actually doing is allowing people to live in circumstances that are very dangerous, that involve drugs and human trafficking and crime.
But that's happening now.
Exactly. And so contributing to that by easing up on the parking restrictions, which is just really nibbling at the edges. And I think that's what we're saying here, is that, as Brian said, a Band-Aid approach, that the city isn't taking a comprehensive approach of what to do about homelessness.
Well, the city is adding shelter space, and right, they're talking about adding more affordable housing, and a vehicle is not nothing. It's a kind of shelter. It's some kind of transition, right?
Right. So I think the larger problem the city faces, and we see it in neighborhoods all across the city, is keeping the city governable. The idea that that there aren't no-go zones for the police, that there aren't areas. This is what the problem with camping in the parks is, that when our civic spaces become unwelcoming and unsafe, then the general public withdraws, and then those are public services that are no longer available. So I think it has to do with establishing order and fairness in how the city enforces its rules, on the one hand, and then also making services available and housing and treatment to get people out of that lifestyle. And with that can go forgiveness of towing or parking charges or other violations. Then once the city determines that a person is accepting housing, that they are in treatment, that they're on a path that leads to a healthy, safe lifestyle, then it's fine to waive a person's parking violations. I don't think the public is going to care about that. But the approach that Councilmember O'Brien is taking, it almost seems like permission to create a level of lawlessness on the street, and I don't think that helps anyone.
But maybe a bunch of parking tickets lands on somebody who can't afford it pretty hard, and you could hope that maybe this will get waived sometime in some compassionate way, but meanwhile you're dealing with tickets and maybe an impound of your home. I mean, how does that help somebody in the moment?
That's a very legitimate point, but I think my sense of Seattle and people who live here is you kind of got to roll it back and look at it the other way. When I represented Vancouver, we had a great mayor, Royce Pollard. And there was a park downtown, and Royce went to visit the park. It was a shooting gallery. People were shooting drugs. They were camping there, etc. A guy crashed his shopping cart into the mayor and said, "Get out of our park."
There you go.
And Royce said, "No, it's not your park. It's our park. It's everybody who lives in Vancouver." And they brought the city leaders and the economic leaders, and they completely revitalized the
downtown. Is it everyone's park? Is it the park of someone who's addicted to heroin?
Here's my point, though.
Does it belong to them?
I think many of us in Seattle feel like Seattle's no longer our community. I am reluctant to walk my kids down Third Avenue because it's a tough street. And so I'll dodge that. I go to parts of Pike Place Market. It's a little spooky. You go to Westgate Mall. And I think a lot of people are pretty tired of that. That doesn't mean you're not compassionate. But it does get to this fundamental question of, Is it our park, the greater city, the taxpaying folks, or is it folks who are not contributing as much as they could? Let's try to help them, but let's not forget that underlying sense of security and value and pride in the city that has to be respected just as much.
So I'm with both of you in some ways here, because look, flexibility at the point of the description you just gave, you have a pile of tickets on your windshield, you're just getting ready to get into housing and that's going to stop you. Of course, we would want flexibility in that situation. I think it has to do with how you market this thing or describe it. You can't go around and say, well, because of that, we want to give up all the livability or the remaining livability that we have. And I think that's where Councilmember O'Brien really needs to listen to folks, their worries about this. You can overdo this, and he is about to overdo this.
And so back to Paul's point. So what we really need is to say, all right, let's seriously look at what is causing this. And this goes to how we deal with the 20% of high school kids who drop out because they've got special needs, or they come from tough backgrounds, or they've got cognitive impairments or whatever. It deals with whether we're providing adequate mental health services. And it's not just to throw money at the problem. That's the other thing we have to stop doing, is measure our compassion by how much programs or money we throw at something. But we do have to say, what are the root causes? What are the consequences for the people in those circumstances, but everybody else who has to cope with that, and then build a comprehensive strategy around that? Back to the mayor's race, I think the candidate who puts that forward will not only get elected, they'll deserve to be elected.
Well, that's the topic of something still under much debate. We're far from new legislation. Probably won't happen until we have a new mayor, but it's being discussed, right?
Yeah.
Tony, you look like you want to interrupt.
Well, the only interruption there is that, you know, when the city budget comes down this fall, there will be a lot of noise as well about which of the service providers for homelessness and some of these social services are going to be renewed. Mm-hmm. Because from what I'm hearing, the mayor's office is going to, you know, they've been reviewing which are the most effective.
Mm-hmm.
And some of that is going to come out in this year's budgeting process. So this may get rolled into all of that.
So we're talking about the idea of possibly easing up on the parking enforcement for people living in their vehicles. Now I want to talk about Seattle's gun tax, which apparently is constitutional. State Supreme Court just said so. The NRA had sued the city for putting a sales tax on guns and ammo, the idea being that Washington cities are not allowed to regulate firearms, not allowed to regulate them. Seattle said, we're not regulating guns, we're taxing guns. And the state Supreme Court says Seattle's right, not even close, 8-1 decision. Is this, Paul, is this an important new precedent, this Supreme Court ruling?
It is, in terms of drawing the line about tax and regulation policy. So you can kind of take the topic, which is guns, out of it. And for wonky people like me,
is taxing regulating?
It's fascinating that, you know, where is a judge going to say that, you know, because as the founding fathers said, you know, 200 years ago, the power to tax something is the power to destroy it. And so, you know, if they can literally tax you out of your home. Any government can do this. So I think what the judge said is that if you're imposing the tax on the sale of a firearm is $25. And I think if the judge had said, well, if the tax were $500, that in effect is banning the sale of firearms. So that falls over into being a regulation. In this case, they said the amount of the tax compared to the thing itself is much more reasonable. And on ammunition, it's like 1 or 2 cents per round of ammunition. So that's why the vote on the court, I think, was overwhelming, that the judges said this is clearly a choice to tax chewing gum, bottled water, firearms.
Alcohol.
Or alcohol. And it's at a level where clearly it's about raising revenue and not about blocking access to a constitutional right.
But when we tax bubble gum, you hear in sugary sodas, the city will say that we want to discourage its use. Does that start to slop over into regulation instead of just raising money?
So again, that comes down to why judges earn their salary, okay? Right. So what they do is they listen to the argument that the city is making in defense of their own tax. The argument might change, but if it meets the requirements of the law, then they'll allow the tax.
Okay. And we can talk about what the money is for. It doesn't raise a lot of money. What does it raise, like $115,000 or $200,000?
$200,000 a year.
I've seen both numbers.
Well, the city estimated it at $300,000 to $500,000 a year, and it was less than $200,000 in its first year.
But it may be zero at some point, because if the underlying idea is to drive firearm sales out of the city altogether. That might be the underlying strategy.
But the city has a public health interest in this tax. It's what do they call it? The Harborview Gun Violence Intervention mm-hmm. Project. And what are they doing with the dough? This was Councilmember Tim Burgess. Shout out to him for this, because think about what they're doing there. They are talking to gunshot victims who come in and are lucky enough to be leaving as well. And on the way out, they are talking to them about how likely they are to return to the hospital with another gunshot wound. And they did this has been done for alcohol folks, and they find that it really, really works. And so that is, if you say, are they discouraging gun violence? Well, yeah, they're discouraging gun violence. Yeah, what do you think?
No, it's not gun violence, because the tax isn't going to do anything about gun violence. It only affects legal gun sales. So this tax, as a tax policy to raise money, the court said, fine. As an anti-crime measure, it does nothing, because it only applies to law-abiding citizens who go to a shop and get a license and buy the firearm. Well, that's not how criminals operate. So
I don't want to fall too deep into that, but if you have people who are changing their behavior after they're gunshot victims, that's a good thing.
Sure.
And let's remember that whether you're pro or anti-gun, the statistics are also pretty clear that a lot of people get shot by legally owned guns. And, you know, the thing I'd like to see myself is an adoption of a national program called non-lethal first. And the idea is to encourage everybody to have a non-lethal mechanism of defense. You read these tragic stories of a father comes out at the night because there's a prowler outside, gets his gun and shoots his own kid trying to climb in late after day. Those kind of things are heartbreaking. If we had a non-lethal first approach in our city with the police sometimes, with and they do that much of the time, but they're perhaps not enough. But, you know, bear spray, something that you can take back. The point I'm making there, Paul's right, the guys who were stealing guns, they aren't paying the tax. But there are a lot of ways we could reduce the toll of gun deaths, not just gun violence in hostel, but gun deaths. And this kind of money could go a long way toward it. And frankly, it'd be very, very well spent. If you could stop one serious gun injury, those are so expensive to the trauma care centers, it'd almost pay for the tax itself right there.
Sure. And the issue here is not the financial cost. Yeah. It's about regulating or taxing firearms.
Yeah. Yeah, kids pick up guns, suicides by guns. There's a lot lot that happens. Okay, so let's pause there on gun tax. It's constitutional. It stays, mm-hmm. right? $25 for a gun. And
maybe I should throw in quickly that this is being carefully watched by the income tax lawsuit.
Why is that?
Well, because that is also a Seattle-based tax in which the city is arguing we have the authority to do this. And the people that are challenging the income tax are making the same argument, similar, I should say, as was made in the gun tax case, which is you, local jurisdiction, don't have the authority to do this. So even though they're two different topics, the two cases are related to each other, because that has to do with the city's authority, the court recognizing the authority of the city to impose taxes.
Okay, guns may be used to get mountain goats out of Olympic National Park. That's a real thing. We'll debate that as the Week in Review continues. Stay tuned. KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for tuning in. We're on Twitter at KUOW. We're reviewing the top stories of the week with Joni Balter and Paul Guppy and Brian Baird. How you doing, Joni?
Good.
Good to have you here. So, I wondered how your eyes were feeling.
Oh,
you doing?
Yeah. A little dusty, a little smoky.
Is Joni's microphone on? There you go. Because if I can't see you, I want to through the haze. I want to at least be able to hear you. Has the smoke affected you personally?
Oh, absolutely.
How's that?
You know, well, look, as Lindy West wrote in the New York Times op-ed, we live in
Seattle's own Lindy West.
Seattle's own. We live in various stages of bargaining with grief during the year because of our weather. Mm. Rainiest season ever. 3 sunny, mild days followed by, you know, what seemed like it was a lovely summer. But it was interrupted by those Canadians and their fires. Mm-hmm. And
Was it really? Has your summer been ruined?
No, not ruined. I said interrupted. So if you're a runner like I am, you have to weigh that.
Have you been not running?
Running anyway, but weighing whether or not I'm making things better or worse while I'm out there choking on. Uh-huh. On the
Are
weather,
you choking?
A little bit. A little.
Are you weighing the idea of choking?
I'm weighing and I'm choking. Uh-huh. There's all of that going on.
Because
I just think it's great. What you wait for here in the Northwest are those blue skies.
Yes.
Now, before we all came in here, the white smoky was going to a little bit bluer. It was. And what a relief. It's nice.
But, you know, before I came here today, one of my sons, who I hope are listening to the radio, but one of them actually asked, Dad, are we going to have smoke like this all the time because of climate change?
Yeah.
And, you know, yes, it's an inconvenience, but it is symptomatic of a serious issue that, again, is not getting the kind of attention it deserves.
What did you tell your son?
I said, we...
How old is his son?
He's 12.
12.
He reads the news, listens to radio.
Yeah, what'd you say to him?
I said, if we don't get climate change under control, there will be more forest fires and there will be hotter temperatures and we owe it to you guys to try to fix it. So, yeah, it's an inconvenience. It spoils our view, but it's symptomatic of something much more serious.
What did your son say through his tears?
Well, you know, this is a really interesting issue. I think our kids really do understand that they're inheriting a mess and the grown-ups haven't solved it.
Aren't we exaggerating the problem a little bit? I realize that yes, climate change is a thing, and... But in the moment, like the Seattle Times had a headline this week and said, I feel trapped. Seattle's smoky, hazy days can't end soon enough. And the story was about how dozens of people had contacted the Seattle Times to share the impact of the haze. And what they did was ask readers how the smoke was affecting their summer. And then they published comments like, it's hard to even enjoy the day-to-day life in Seattle, exclamation mark. Without the blue sky and views, having a nice summer is useless. I feel trapped, sad emoji face. Really?
We need a smoky emoji.
Smoky emoji. Yeah.
Mokoji, we'll call it.
Yeah. What I thought of is we love Canadian imports, but this is one that we don't need from our neighbors to the north. But to me, it hasn't ruined my family's summer. We've been out doing things. But it definitely does create a kind of a gloom. And to me, what it really drives home, a little bit...
A warm, dry gloom.
Well,
it's not really gloomy,
it makes
it?
You appreciate what a clean environment means.
It does.
Yes.
Really experiencing it. So I'm sure that back in, I don't know, the 60s or 70s, when there was more industrial pollution in the air, it makes you appreciate that we don't live with that generally, that clear air and clean skies is definitely the way to
go. There's a positive way to think of
LA,
it.
Absolutely, because it's temporary. So now the Canadian smoke will clear, and hopefully we'll be left with a clear impression of what it's like to live with polluted atmosphere.
You know, Paul, you're right.
Remember that for the future.
LA used to look like this.
Yeah, exactly.
A lot. And, you know, those who say, well, let's crush the Clean Air Act or something, there were government regulations that came into place and cleared that air up. But, you know, you went in 1960s, early 70s to L.A., it looked a lot like this.
Yep. So air does clear. You're saying this is not a permanent situation.
Well, yeah, because fires will go out, but also because we've cut back on a lot of the
pollution. We have a steel plant in Seattle, in West Seattle, near where I live, and, you know, it's got a stack, and what comes off of it is steam all the time.
Right, because of the cleaning.
And so, you know, you see that, and that's what a steel mill should be like, as opposed to what it was in the past, with black smoke coming out of smokestacks. It's much better now.
I saw people on social media going, winds from the south, yay, because those are the ones that can wipe it out of here, and they're coming. Eventually, they keep saying.
Quote, haven't seen the mountains in days, creating a terrible craving for distant horizons. Yesterday, I could hardly find Seattle's skyline. Quote, it kills me what's happening to my beautiful Pacific Northwest. Quote, apocalyptic skies make the apocalyptic news even more surreal.
It's pretty dysphoric. I mean, there are times you look at this red sun setting and the sort of sick-looking...
Beautiful, isn't it? The red sun?
It's like living in the Matrix.
Yeah. Or Tatooine, as one of my sons said.
There you go.
You can hardly see the goats in the Olympic Mountains.
Nice segue, Jonah. How can you see them to shoot them?
Yes, how can you see?
Okay. Well, that does create a problem, doesn't it?
Let's talk about the Sentinel Mountain goats. What to do? So somebody, in case... I hadn't known this. Somebody brought mountain goats into the Olympic Mountains.
They were introduced.
Yes, introduced 100 years ago for the purpose of hunting.
Correct.
They are native to the North Cascades and I think Mount Rainier too. But there are hundreds of them now, and they are messing up Olympic Na- what's now, it, this is before, they were brought in before it was a national park. Mm-hmm. Now it's a national park.
Right.
The mountain goats are doing this.
There are 14 different plant species that only live there, nowhere else in the world. There are several other creatures. The Olympic marmot is a variety of marmot that only lives there. So they've all grown up together. They've all evolved in this ecosystem, and there is a balance there. The goats are placing this out of balance because they're not just a few of them. There are a lot of them, and it's time to set things right.
Mountain goats pester hikers because they like salt and they know we're sweaty.
And yeah. Pee.
And pee.
And pee, yes. The goats have a lot of information about us.
Yes.
About our fluids.
All they need to know.
I hike in the Olympics all the time. I'm going next week.
Have you ever seen a mountain goat?
Yes.
How close?
Bears. Well, the closest I've ever been is about 12 feet away.
And what did you do?
Well, I looked and took pictures.
Yeah.
You don't get any closer than that.
They don't like...
They're unafraid of people.
Exactly. They've become
and if you're
less
at high elevations where it's open and clear, you can see them pretty regularly. Hurricane Ridge is an area where they are.
It's an interesting problem when a charismatic megafauna is an invasive species.
Right.
It's one thing if it's spartina grass or something. Yeah. And, you know, I think the ecologists are right. I think we have to remove the goats. I should, in disclosure, I'm a vegetarian. But I grew up hunting, and I recognize that sometimes you've got a species that has to be controlled and you don't have sufficient natural predators. And if they were not indigenous to begin with, I think we have to remove them. And I hope we can do it in a humane way and possibly provide the meat to shelters or something. But as a vegetarian...
Well, what's the worst case scenario of the invasive, charismatic megafauna?
Well, they're goats. I mean, anybody seen what goats can do to an ecosystem? And the high mountain meadows are incredibly fragile.
And they killed a hiker a few years back.
They did kill a hiker, with its horns. But so it's, I just want to understand it as vividly as I can, what the threat is. So the plants that are in the Olympic Mountains, they get eaten up by the goats, and they're completely—they don't exist anymore.
Well, these are alpine.
Because they would be easier to reintroduce than goats would be, right?
These are alpine areas where the plants are struggling anyway because of the high altitude. It's a harsh environment. Also, you know, the wildflowers are beautiful. The plants are fantastic.
Right.
You can't even believe that they can survive.
Are they charismatic?
At these altitudes. Well, as
are
plants,
they charismatic
I guess they
plants?
Are. They're tough plants. But the area is delicate. I mean, even for hikers and campers are told to stay out of certain areas because of the impact that you'll have. These goats are big. As I said, they're completely unafraid of humans. But the other thing I was going to mention is that the Park Service also has a kind of legacy attitude where sometimes they'll say, if a hunting cabin was built, we're just going to leave it there. It's been there 100 years. And also lakes in the Alpine Lakes Wilderness all have fish in them. They were all introduced. Yeah. They're not natural. So the Park Service could come to a point where they say, we realize that the goats are part of the park at a certain level. And I think the fact that they're getting to be more than 600 of them, that when the population gets
they've been multiplying quite a bit.
Right,
that's
then the impact is
folks,
more.
Right.
So I haven't heard anybody say that the goats should be taken down to, you know, zero. You probably wouldn't be able to get rid of them all. But the Park Service may decide to control the population by moving some of them to reduce
the impact
talking
about.
On...
That's exactly plants. What they're talking about. Does this remind anybody of the Canada geese from about 10, 12 years ago in Seattle?
The lake poopers?
That would be those. That would be the exact Canada geese. Mm-hmm. And we're really wailing on Canada here today. We're gonna
thanks, Canada.
Let's send the goats to Canada.
Yeah. Sure. But anyway, so do you remember what happened here? And it's a very unpopular thing to mention. So here I go. What they did was they tried a couple things. They addled the eggs for a while. Didn't work that well. They shipped them.
What is addling?
Coating the egg in a way so it won't
hatch. Or oil
on
it so the egg can't hatch.
Yeah. Oh. And the next thing they did...
We invented a word for pouring oil on
them? No, they already had that word. But then they deported them to Eastern Washington. I'm pretty sure I saw a few of their cousins over there at Lake Chelan a couple weeks ago. And then in the end, they rounded them up, like 3,000 of them or some number like that, and they...
They sent them to a Canada goose farm upstate?
No.
Where they can be...
They actually gassed them.
Oh.
Yeah. So I'm not advocating that for the goats, but either they go to work clearing brush... Or we'll have to try to manage that population.
Well, listen, this guy you heard a moment ago, he does want to kill every last goat, or get rid of every last goat. Rob Smith, National Parks Conservation Association, the Park Service is considering trapping the mountain goats and moving them to the North Cascades and Mount Rainier, but the ones they can't trap, they would shoot to kill. And then I had on the same conversation from the Northwest Animal Rights Network, Rachel Bjork, raised her hand.
What I'm wondering is why we can't look at other solutions in terms of like using a chemical birth control, which might be actually less invasive than, you know, relocating a bunch and killing a bunch and leaving their dead bodies all over the place.
Yeah, how would this contraception work?
So you would shoot them still, but you wouldn't kill them. You would use, you know, a dart gun. And it's been shown to work about 3 years. So since mountain goats have a lifespan of about 10, you may have to do it twice, but you'd only have to do it to the females, of course.
Of course. But Rob...
Always picking on the women.
Always, right? Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, try to get a condom on a mountain goat. It's almost impossible. Not impossible, but I'm telling you, it's virtually impossible.
It would run afoul of the Hyde Amendment, too. I think you're using federal funds.
Yes, federal funds. It's a national park. So this proponent of... of trapping and killing says, look, we can't get to every single mountain goat with the birth control chemicals. You have to kill the ones you can't reach or else they're going to keep breeding and we will be dealing with this forever.
As long as they pay the ammunition and firearm tax.
Or you can teach abstinence classes up at Hurricane Ridge, a little abstinence class, set the sign up.
Good idea.
Goats would attend. They would abstain just like
they would. They would come because they like to be near you because in case they can get some salt. So they yes. have a motive to attend.
Yes, they do. You come for the salt, stay for the contraception classes.
You know, you could just throw it out there and seek volunteers for the goat condom program and just see how that goes.
It's a make-work program.
Kind of.
You're going to exercise anyway. If you have a health club membership, you might as well go do the mountain goat condom application.
Yeah, I don't know what technique would be used. But.
So did we decide? You know, they're taking
the reason this conversation devolved is because
okay,
of what...
Exactly.
Yeah, sorry. So they're taking public comment on until September 26th, National Park Service. Finally, does anyone care that the Mariners are technically, if the world ended today, if there were a nuclear war between the U.S. and North Korea and everything ended, the Mariners would technically be in the playoffs because they're tied right now
for a one-game
playoff to be in the second wild card spot. They're nowhere near the World Series, but that's something. Do you care?
They'd be all worried about their pitching because that's the problem. The folks are hitting pretty well for the Mariners, but Felix is injured and
Jackson.
Another Canadian, not that there's anything wrong with it, pitcher.
That's right.
He may or may not be really injured because we don't seem to, I don't know the final report on that from last night.
James Paxton, yeah. Hurt some kind of way.
Hurt.
Lefty or righty, Joni?
Blah.
Joni Balter is ambidextrous, apparently. Brian Baird, lefty, righty?
Paxton or am I?
That's
you.
I'm right-handed.
Right-handed. Okay. Paul Guppy?
I'm left-handed.
Excellent.
Means, when I play, I have to take off the glove to throw.
KOW's Week in Review. Thanks all. Appreciate it.